You're listening to the micro version of the Savage Lovecast, www.savagelovecast.com.
If you're stuck in a relationship quandary, or if you're looking for sexual harmony, well, there's nothing you can't ask on the Savage Lovecast.
If there's anything Jerry Falwell Jr. hates, it's those damn liberal elites. It's all over his Twitter feed, his contempt for those wealthy and decadent Hollywood types laying around their pools and then flying off on their private jets, cavorting with pool boys and personal trainers. Speaking of pool boys, Jerry Falwell Jr., the president of Liberty University, met a hot young man, a pool boy, at a luxury Miami Beach hotel in 2012. And soon Giancarlo Granda, the pool boy, was flying around the country with Falwell and his wife Becky on Liberty University's private jet. Jesus may have gotten into Jerusalem on an ass, but we can't expect Falwell and his wife to fly coach, now can we? Less than a year after meeting this hot pool boy, you might want to get online and look at the pics, hot pool boy. And less than a year after picking up that hot pool boy poolside, and less than a year after jetting off with that hot pool boy, the Falwells would put up nearly $5 million to buy that hot pool boy a hotel in Miami Beach. You know, like you do. And before you judge Falwell, let he who has not picked up a hot pool boy on vacation and then taken him home on your private jet and then helped him buy a hotel cast the first stone. Backing up for a second, Jerry Falwell Jr. is the son of Liberty University's founder, Jerry Falwell Sr., and apparently the presidency of Liberty University gets passed from father to son because evangelical colleges are hereditary asshole aristocracies. Falwell Sr., of course, famously blamed the attacks of 9/11 on gays and lesbians. Falwell Jr., just as anti-gay as his late and not lamented dad was, and anti-choice too. He's a family values religious conservative, and he played a really important role in the 2016 election. Falwell Jr. was the first prominent evangelical leader to endorse Donald Trump, serial adulterer and accused rapist. Falwell vouched for Trump's personal morality and Trump's faith and his relationship with Jesus Christ. Falwell's endorsement convinced other evangelical leaders to get on board, to jump on the Trump train. If Falwell had endorsed, say, Ted Cruz, which Ted Cruz was expecting him to do, it's fair to say that Donald Trump might not be president today. Now, here's the funny thing we learned after the election. Before endorsing Trump, Falwell reached out to Michael Cohen, Trump's fixer, that lawyer who's now in jail, like a lot of people who worked with Trump, because Falwell Jr. had a problem. He'd had a falling out with the pool boy, and in perhaps a related development, there were some compromising photos floating around out there. And Michael Cohen offered to help get those photos back and have them destroyed. And shortly after Cohen did Falwell Jr. that favor, shortly after Cohen may have come into possession of those photos, Jerry Falwell Jr. endorsed Cohen's boss, Donald Trump, in 2016. Yeah, things that make you go, mm-hmm. And remember personal trainers and Hollywood elites and all that? Yesterday, Reuters broke the news that in 2016, Falwell sold a sprawling sports complex that was owned by Liberty University to his personal trainer, a hot young man named Benjamin Crosswhite. Crosswhite was Falwell's personal trainer. Crosswhite, like Granda, flew here and there with Falwell on his private jet. And according to Reuters, the university basically gave that sports facility it owned to Crosswhite on Jerry Falwell Jr.'s orders. The university financed the sale. Crosswhite didn't have to put up any money. And then the university immediately turned around and leased back the tennis courts from Crosswhite that the university had owned 5 minutes ago. Pool boys, personal trainers, makes you wonder which gay porn cliche comes next. The pizza delivery guy, the drill sergeant, the inexplicably hot considering how much time they spend sitting on their asses, truck driver, makes you think. But while some folks are wondering what the pool boy and the personal trainers might indicate about Falwell's sexual orientation, could another anti-gay social conservative be secretly gay? I don't think this is a scandal about a closeted gay man. Closeted gay men meet up with hot guys and pick up pool boys and hit on personal trainers, sure, but they don't do that shit with and in front of their wives. Those compromising photos Cohen may have destroyed, according to the Miami Herald, they weren't of Jerry Falwell Jr., They were of his much younger, much hotter wife, Becky, the same wife the pool boy spent time with, the same wife Falwell's personal trainer trained personally. As unbelievable as it might seem, Falwell could actually be something worse in the eyes of his fellow right-wingers and Trump supporters and MAGA hat-wearing assholes. Based on all of the evidence at hand, I don't think Jerry Falwell Jr. is secretly gay. And you know what? Thank God. We got stuck with Aaron Schock. We don't deserve Jerry Falwell Jr. No. Picking up pool boys with the wife, sharing a personal trainer with the wife, sending out compromising photos of the wife, that's not how closeted gay men roll. That's how straight male cuckolds roll. And there's nothing wrong with being a cuck. And again, we don't know for sure if Jerry Falwell Jr. is a cuck. But try saying there's nothing wrong with being a cuck to Jerry Falwell Jr.'s buddies on the right, where cuck has become the go-to insult, the term hurled in the faces of Democrats, liberals, progressives, even Republicans and right-wingers who deviate an inch from Trump's policies and his bigotries. There's nothing worse you can be called on the right than a cuck. How ironic would it be if Donald Trump owed his presidency to one? All right, coming up on today's show, on the micro free edition of the Savage Lovecast, lots of your Qs, lots of my A's, and Paul Sullivan, money columnist for the New York Times, joins us to talk prenups and marriage. And on the Magnum subscription edition of the Savage Lovecast, Dr. Jen Gunter is back to talk with us about vaginas, and her new book, The Vagina Bible. All that coming up on today's show. This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Everlane, luxury basic clothing and accessories made at ethical factories without those retail markups. For free shipping and to support the Lovecast, go to everlane.com/savage. This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Talkspace, online therapy that makes it easy to get extra support. Use the offer code SAVAGE for $65 off your first month. Go to Talkspace.com and use the offer code SAVAGE. Have you heard about Eva? It is a vibrator for couples that provides hand-free clitoral stimulation in a small, powerful package. And it's made by Dame Products, a woman-founded company making the world a better place, one vulva at a time. Visit dameproducts.com/savage to learn more.
Hey, Dan. I'm a gay 29-year-old, so I don't really go to Pride very often. I went to Pride this year, and while I was dancing, something I saw just took me back so much that I could barely contain myself. And it was mostly that Pride is supposed to be like a thing, in my opinion, that really is like a place for people to show their spirit and their acceptance and love of who they are. And I think that families should be able to go. I think straight people should be able to take their kids to show that gay people are just normal people. Basically, I was dancing and I noticed like 5 feet away from me, there was like a circle of men around a guy who was eating another guy out. And that was just so ridiculous in my mind. And I just couldn't believe that, you know, and I'm of a lot of demographics. I'm black and I'm white. And it feels just like I always see someone making me look bad, whether it's a white person or a black person. But when I saw gay people doing it, I was just like, it was like there was nowhere to run from the obscenities. If you could just speak to that so that, like, some people can hear it, I feel like it needs to be said. I feel like it needs to be, like, a bell that's rung for gay people. Like, hey, keep your sex acts indoors, you know? Like, wear all the leather you want, show all the skin you want. But as far as, like, sex acts, like, some people want to bring their kids to Pride. I know straight couples who have kids and they're progressive and they want to bring their kids there to, like, learn about Pride. I'm not so worried about the judgment as just, like, impact this will actually have on people.
So Alex Smith, who is this CrossFit professional athlete, you can follow him on Instagram. A lot of people were already following him on Instagram. He has 300,000-400,000 followers, and he's very famous in CrossFit circles as a professional CrossFit athlete. He's also fucking gorgeous. Just came out as gay, posted this heartfelt video to his Instagram account coming out as gay. He cries in it. I got a text message from a friend because someone took a screenshot of Alex Smith in this heartbreaking, lovely, tender, vulnerable video with tears in his eyes and made a meme and a mean joke out of it and posted it on the internet. And the person who did that was a gay guy. And my friend was really upset because why do people have to be such fucking assholes? And we talked for a minute. We just texted back and forth for a minute because it's always so disappointing when it's a gay person who's being an asshole. And we have to remind ourselves, of course, that some of everybody's an asshole. We expect better of gay people, our fellow gay people sometimes. And then we are disappointed when our fellow gay people prove that which we should assume to be true, that the same significant percentage of them, us, are assholes, just like the same significant percentage of everybody fucking else. But why is it so crushing when gay people are awful? Well, I guess because we're all implicated somehow because of the way minorities are treated in this country, of whatever stripe they happen to be. But also we want to think well of ourselves and we want to think we're pretty good. And so we project that, hey, I'm pretty good. I'm a pretty good gay person, onto all of the gay people. And when they prove themselves to be jerks at the same rate as everybody else, we take it personally. All right, you were at Pride. There was a little scrum of gay men in the middle of wherever it was that people were dancing. You say there was a little circle and there was somebody in the middle of that circle. As you got close enough, you could see that the someone in the middle of that circle was eating somebody else out, eating some dude's ass, I assume. And you're mad and you're upset because what about the straight people? And what about the kids who come to Pride? Pride is about sexuality. Pride is about people celebrating their sexuality. Sexuality and sexual expression has always been a part of Pride, always had a place at Pride. And so I'm less upset about this than you are, I think. But I get why you're upset. I get why you took that personally, because my friend and I took it personally when that asshole gay dude made fun of Alex Smith for coming out in the way that they did. But I got to say, when you come to Pride, you're going to see some people being sexual. And the line you want to draw, no public sex acts. Other people want to draw a line that says no leather, no drag, no puppy masks. A lot of things that you would allow, others would not allow. So the drawing of those lines about expression at an event like Pride are inherently problematic. And it would be my advice to parents of small children who want to go to Pride not to crowd onto the dance floor, not to approach scrums of men, because that's where this sort of thing, ass eating, is highly likely to happen. And while the guys didn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy by forming a little scrum, by taking it onto a crowded dance area, they were creating a little site-specific level of privacy. I doubt very much that people are dancing with their three-year-olds in the middle of giant scrums of gay men at a Pride celebration. And if they are, well, they run the risk of seeing gay men grinding on each other, or worse, or better, depending on your perspective. And people have been screaming at the folks at Pride who are too sexual or too kinky or too undressed or too whatever else to knock it off, and they're making us all look bad since the very first Pride parade 49 years ago. And the people who say this, oh, it's making us all look bad, it's going to set the queer rights movement back. Well, political observers, sociologists, commentators, everyone has acknowledged that the LGBT civil rights movement got further faster than most other social justice movements. And that's because of our secret weapon. We are randomly distributed throughout the population. We are born into mostly straight families. And that helped advance the cause. So it seems that these things can't exist simultaneously. Oh, these people who are being filthy birds at Pride are going to set us back, and we are at once making remarkable advances at historic speeds. If the former, all the guys misbehaving at Pride, all the other people misbehaving at Pride, some of the straight people who come to Pride to misbehave, and I'm using misbehave in quotes there, were going to set us back, well, we couldn't have made the advances that we've made. So it's really not the threat that some people think it is. And we're just going to have to, it's one of the things that Pride exists to promote. All right, we're just going to have to learn to live with it, get used to it, tolerate it. There's always going to be some folks at Pride who are getting dirty on the dance floor or in the corners or in the dark. And that kind of sexual freedom is part of what we're celebrating.
Hi, Dan. So this weekend, I met a guy who's in town just for the weekend. And we ended up going home together and having kinkier sex than I've ever had before. We had really great communication and we got to really act out some things that I've been imagining in my head for a while. And it was really great, but it was so temporary and so one night standy that like then a few days later, I've just been feeling really dejected. Like maybe because some of the stuff we did was kind of degrading towards me. And so I'm wondering, you know, I'm a single woman and I'd like to incorporate this kind of sex into my single lifestyle, but not really interested in having a boyfriend or even really, you know, getting involved in anything too emotionally intimate. So how do you kind of manage that feeling of like not feeling totally degraded after having this kind of sex with also a really single lifestyle?
By reminding yourself that this is role play, this is cops and robbers for grownups with your pants off and orgasms, and you are choosing to play this out. You are choosing with this person that you had a good feeling about and that you trusted in the moment to engage in this kind of scripted drama. So while you're going through these degrading motions, you're in control and you are in charge, and it can end when you decide that it ends. And if your partner sticks to the parameters to what you negotiated and agreed to in advance, you are in control. And so it's not degradation. It's a ritual performance. It's catharsis. And it provides you with some release and it turns you the fuck on. And you want to have in your life the things that turn you on. Part of what may be making you feel a little squicky after the fact about this is that you did these things with someone that you're not going to see again. And that's really where your question goes. How do you incorporate these things when you're not wanting to have an intimate relationship, when you're not wanting to have a love connection into the sex you're having without having then to feel bad about it? And it's almost like you were suggesting that if this had happened in the context of a committed, loving relationship, that would be exculpatory somehow. That the fact that that it's the combo of this kind of kinky sex and casual sex, those things together make this worse. That the halo of, oh, but this is the way my lover and I, in the context of our committed loving relationship, connect sexually, that makes this stuff okay. This stuff can be okay in the context of a very short-term relationship. You came into contact with this guy. It sounds like you had an extended conversation with this guy before you met up. You met up. You had a good feeling about him. You had a great one-night stand. Rather than allowing the culture to convince you that you have to frame that as somehow sleazy, not the sex that you had, but the briefness of that relationship that you had, because it was brief, because it wasn't long-term, because it's not open-ended, because you're not dating, because he's not your husband, it makes it all not okay. You don't have to buy into that. You have to buy into the shit that I'm selling here. You had a successful short-term relationship with this guy. You had sex that turned you on. You felt good about him and you felt safe enough with him to open yourself up in this way and explore this part of your sexuality. And you had a positive experience. Yahtzee. You won. Do your legwork in advance, always, with people that you're going to engage in this kind of sex with. And even if they're only in your life for a night, if you had fun, they had fun, nobody got hurt, and you never see them again, it was a successful relationship. And you don't need love and commitment and long-term to legitimize your desires or make the things that you did with this guy or you might do with other guys that you meet in the future that you have these brief flings with, good and decent. You created more joy in the world for you and for that guy. The one piece that may have been missing for you is aftercare. When you do serious role play, when you get into humiliation or degradation, the kinksters talk about this. It's important after the scene for the person who topped you or humiliated you or degraded you or tied you up and called you names to shower you with affection, to hold you, to connect and bring you back out of it. I don't want to say comfort you, but it is a kind of a comfort where you let go of both roles, where you let go of your submission and they let go of their dominance, and you just reconnect as equals and human beings. Sometimes when people have a kinky sex date with someone that they're not going to see again, the intimacy of aftercare feels like it might be misleading. Like the person who's providing you with that aftercare might wind up feeling like they're making you a promise about an emotional commitment that they don't want to make and that you didn't ask for and that you, caller, didn't want either. So part of the thing you want to talk about in advance of a scene like this with someone that you're not going to see again or someone you're going to hang out with for a weekend or an evening is that aftercare is important, and you don't misinterpret aftercare to mean that they have to see you again ever, or that they're your boyfriend now, or anything. But after this play, after this scene, if we're going to do this kind of degradation, humiliation, power exchange-y kind of play, I'm going to need some time being cuddled, being held, and us being nice and decent to each other. We just can't blow our loads in the context of this degradation scene and then pull our pants on and leave. And you can make that a condition of doing this kind of play with anybody, whether you're going to do it with them on and off for 50 years when you're married to them forever, or you're going to do that one Saturday night in New York when you made a date to do that. You can make it a condition. And I think if you get a little bit of aftercare after the play, you'll feel less conflicted after they leave. Would you buy a t-shirt for $50 if you knew it only cost $7 to make? We wouldn't. With Everlane, you won't have to, because with Everlane, you never overpay for quality clothes. Everlane only makes premium essentials using the finest materials without traditional markups. And they want you to know what you're paying for and why. So Everlane tells you their real costs, and they are radically transparent about every step in their process, from the materials they use to the ethical factories they work with. No matter your style or preference, Everlane's clothes look better, cost less, and last longer. Because Everlane sells directly to you, their prices are 30 to 50% lower than traditional retailers. Essentials, like their Cotton Crew t-shirt, are exactly what they should be. Versatile, simple, stylish, and made from quality materials that you did not overpay for. They have a beautiful selection of 100% grade A cashmere. I love their premium Japanese denim, and Nancy especially loves their outerwear made from recycled water bottles. Check out our personalized collection at everlane.com/savage. Plus, you will get free shipping on your first order. That's everlane.com/savage. Everlane.com/savage.
Hi, Dan. I am calling because I was hoping you could give a little primer on money in relationships as people get married. I'm 26 and my boyfriend's 28, and we're looking to get married, which is great. I have a much higher net worth, much higher salary than he does. And we've been sharing finances for 2 years, and the way we currently do it is we have separate accounts that we both contribute to a joint account from which everything is that we have as shared finances is purchased, and it works really well. But as we look to getting married, he is talking about combining our finances completely. And this makes sense because there are things like retirement savings and insurance and big purchases that he will not continue to be able to make on his own, but would benefit me to have in a partner. Both my parents are divorced. They were long-term single people. I have multiple other adults in my life who are like that. So I don't have a lot of role models for people who have combined finances. He's completely fine sharing a or signing a prenup and is open to changing, you know, how we do our money. But that is his input so far. And I was just hoping that you and maybe your listeners could talk about a couple different ways married people share money. If it is just like put it all in one big pot and that's the way that makes sense, you know, that's most practical, or just some different ideas. Neither one of us has any debt and we don't plan to have children. So we're in a pretty good financially stable position. And I just want to have a couple ideas about what to do as we make this big life decision together.
Joining me by phone to help tackle this question, Paul Sullivan is the Wealth Matters columnist for the New York Times and the author of The Thin Green Line, The Money Secrets of the Super Wealthy. Hey, Paul, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on today, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I understand you're on vacation and you took a moment away, and we really appreciate it because I have no idea what to tell her. She asked for a primer on money and relationships when people get married. I'm sure you could talk for 3 hours about that, but can you give us the short version? What do people need to know about finances before they marry?
Hey, you know what? She's ahead of the game by even thinking about this. So let's give her credit for that. You know, even though it sounds like it comes from a place of fear or at least concern, most people kind of stumble blithely into a relationship, let alone marriage, without even tackling these issues. But, you know, from my experience, you know, from the column, from the book, from a lot of the research I've done independently, I mean, conversations like this about money aren't about money. They're never about money. And you can sort of, some of it, you can tell the way she frames it, it's about concern. It's about, you know, security. She says that she doesn't have any good role models around shared finances because her parents are divorced. You know, money at the end of the day is just a means of exchange. If we have more money, we have more choices. If we have less money, we don't have that many choices. But where money screws us up is when it has all of this psychological baggage attached to it. And I'm not saying that in any disparaging way to the caller. I have psychological baggage around money. You do too. We all do. It's inevitable.
I have so much. I can't have a conversation about money without crawling under a table, ask anyone who's ever negotiated a contract with me. But this is, I think, something that more people are facing, where they're thinking about merging their finances. One person makes significantly more money than the other. I've actually talked about this on the show in the past. And, you know, I'm kind of a pour it all into a common pot and then try not to bankrupt each other and yourselves as a couple, Irish Catholic, don't think about it too much type. But can people maintain separate finances? Can they keep doing what they're doing and be married, where she has her money, he has his money, and they have a joint account for shared expenses?
Look, people do this all the time. You know, I think it's strange. I think it's can be a recipe for disaster, if not disaster, at least frustration. But I have a lot of friends who do this. You know, my wife and I, and she makes more money than I do, we were of the, from the beginning, she was the one who said, well, you know, we're in this together. Let's just pour it all into a bucket. Now, this caller says, you know, she's not going to have kids. She and her husband aren't going to have kids. At 26, I didn't think I was going to have kids either. Yeah, I think, you know, I have three kids now. Once you add to the complexity of life, I think it becomes a lot more difficult to keep things separate. What are you going to do if you want to take a vacation and it costs, I don't know, $10,000? Well, splitting it in half could be difficult for the partner. You know, right. Do you have to work something out where she pays 70% and he pays 30 or 80-20? That becomes a bit challenging. What if he wants to, you know, splurge on, I don't know what his hobby is. You know, mine's golf. What if he wants to spend $400 on a new putter or something like that? Well, is she going to get upset that he did that because, you know, he should be contributing more? It gets really fraught. But the other issue here, Dan, is in some states, she can do whatever she wants. Unless the money is held in trust, it doesn't matter. I mean, take California, for example. California is a community property state. So, I mean, she says she's more financially well off, but that's always a general term. I mean, does that mean she has $100,000 in the bank? Does that mean she has $10 million in the bank? I don't know. Presumably, if she had $10 million in the bank, a lot of it would be locked up in trust, and that would protect it. If she has $100,000 in the bank, well, how is she going to keep that separate? Because a community property state like California is going to say, you know what? You've been married for X number of years. We're going to say that everything created during this marriage is split 50-50. And they do that just to avoid, you know, the total messiness that may come when somebody gets divorced. Mm-hmm. And this has happened in cases with gigantic amounts of money. There was this Boston real estate developer who bought the Los Angeles Dodgers, I don't know, 10 years ago. He eventually got divorced. The divorce laws in Massachusetts are completely different from the divorce laws in California. So now he had this, you know, however much the Dodgers were worth back then, a couple $1 billion, you know, franchise, and he was looking at having to split it 50-50. That's just the way the state looks at it. So depending on where she lives, there's only so much control she can exert over keeping their finances separate if the marriage goes south.
But what you're saying about, you know, in answer to her question, how do married people share money? They do it in all sorts of different ways. But this, you know, if you make, you know, if your income is shared income is you make 70% of the money, he makes 30%, you keep it separate, he pays 30% of the mortgage, you pay 70% of the mortgage. Applying that to every single expense, you're going to need an accountant to run that side of your marriage. And it just might be easier if you pooled your resources and treated it as your money. And in the end, you know, she's asked about a prenup. In the end, if you wind up getting divorced and you're in a community property state, just going to get split 50-50 anyway. So
100%, Dan. But the bigger issue here, again, it's not the money. That's not the money. It's about having those conversations, about having, you know, a trust relationship. You know, I have good friends who, I don't know if they still do it, but they have a couple kids, and they were honestly splitting things, you know, if not down the middle, like I'm going to buy this new couch and it's my money so I can buy it. Well, if my house was decorated that way, with me buying one piece of furniture and my wife buying one piece of furniture, it'd be a complete, you know, clown show. You have to come to these, you know, decisions together. You're entering a marriage. You're not roommates anymore. You're not roommates. You're not dating. You're committing your life to one another, you know, the whole sickness and health thing. So what happens if you know, the husband who makes less money, you know, he needs a kidney replacement? Does he have to pay 30% himself and she'll kick in the other 70? I mean, when people start testing the logic of keeping everything separate, it gets a bit tenuous.
I think the concern often for the person who makes a lot more money than someone else is that once we merge finances, their partner is going to turn into a spendthrift, is going to run through my money. And I think if my advice would be, if that's a concern for you about your partner before the marriage, maybe that's a sign that's not someone you want to marry.
Exactly. 100%. Like, you know, any of us who've been married for a long time can tell you, people don't change. You know, people, you may be able to change somebody. It's all about partner selection in the beginning. So if the guy is burning through money now, chances are he's going to keep burning through money now. If he's very responsible with money now, why would that suddenly change?
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, though, I mean, her fears are very real fears, and I don't want to downplay them. And plenty of people live this, you know, split life over finances. But I just think it's incredibly complicated, and the money becomes a mask for all these other issues that should be dealt with. I mean, clearly, you know, her parents are divorced. She doesn't have good money role models. She doesn't want to end up in that same predicament. She doesn't want to end up like they did.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not about money. That's about having a conversation. It's about, you know, really loving the person you're going to be with, about trusting that person, about opening it up. Again, it's not about who's going to pay the electric bill this month.
And it's about making choices together. Because if it turns into, you know, here's a choice we'd like to make together. Well, I don't want to make that choice. Okay, I'm just going to spend my money on it. It just seems
exactly.
like an engine for conflict. You know, and every fucking relationship is an engine for conflict to a certain extent. And like whether you should be in a relationship or not is whether, you know, the question is, can you resolve conflict and how do you process conflict as
right.
a couple? And setting up a financial system where either of you can do whatever you want without having to consult with the other, having to come to an agreement with the other, because you can just revert to, well, I'm, you know, you didn't want to get that couch or that putter, so that's my money I'm spending. Oh my God, that just seems like unnecessarily contentious, and it seems to short circuit the conflict resolution process that really does need to be at the heart of a committed long-term relationship. You need to always be refining and exercising that skill for it to survive over the long term. And if you end up getting divorced, you're going to split everything 50-50 anyway, so might as well be in the same pot.
Right. Otherwise, you're absolutely right. I mean, money can become an accelerant for all kinds of things. An accelerant for good. You can do more good things more quickly, but it can also accelerate, you know, conflict. I mean, some of the best financial advisors I've interviewed over the years say, look, decide how much money you need to save each year so that you can reach your financial goals, whatever they may be, retirement, buy a house, put some kids through college, whatever. And once you hit that number every month, don't worry so much about everything else. If you got an extra $2,000, an extra $10,000, whatever it is, well, enjoy it. And this seems to me like an impediment to using money for a means of enjoyment, because I just don't think it's possible that the spouse who has less isn't going to feel like he's on some sort of allowance, or he has to ask his wife if he can spend this and not that, or if he's overly deferential. If she wants to buy the ugliest couch he's ever seen in his life, he says, well, okay, you can do it. It's your money. Or, you know, can I choose one of the cushions because that's 30% mine? It's really, you know, ridiculous when we lay it out. But again, that fear that she has is real. I mean, I would suggest that she and her husband to be really sit down and talk about the things that scare them about a relationship, and the things that scare them about spending. How do they want to save? You know, does one want to live in an ultra modern house? Does one other want to live in an 18th century colonial? Who knows? You know, have some of these conversations ahead of time, so there aren't surprises 5-10 years down the road when maybe work's stressful, maybe a parent is sick, you know, and then you have to really kind of be together as a couple.
The one thing we didn't address, the one question she asked, and then we're gonna have to let you go. Prenups, good idea or bad?
Look, people do them all the time. If the husband is willing to go along with it, it's just saying, okay, you know, the money you bring into this marriage, you're gonna hive it off, and you know, it's going to be yours if anything goes wrong. I mean, it's neither a good nor bad idea. It's just a financial instrument.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the question again then is, can she keep all that money separate? Because if she lives in a state where they find out that her, let's say, $1 million that she has she's been drawing on that $1 million each month to fund their lifestyle. Well, that's suddenly, you know, community property, you know, and so it becomes fairly tangled, fairly difficult. But look, if that gives her peace of mind, if he's willing to go along with it, let's hope they're married for 40 years and this never becomes an issue. And the prenup is the prenup. It's just a piece of paper. And they look back and they laugh about it on their 40th wedding anniversary.
Paul Sullivan, Wealth Matters columnist for The New York Times and author of The Thin Green Line, The Money Secrets of the Super Wealthy. Thank you so much for jumping on the phone, especially on your vacation. We appreciate it.
Dan, thanks for having me on. I loved it.
As we've discussed on the show before, new ideas in the bedroom can add flavor to what you already enjoy. And way back in 2014, a two-woman startup called Dame Products broke the internet with a new idea of their own. They invented Eva, a vibrator for couples that provides hands-free clitoral stimulation. Eva's crowdfunding campaign made $575,000, making it the most crowdfunded sex toy in history. People responded to this idea. People wanted this toy. And 5 years later, Dame Products is on the front lines of sexual wellness with four vibrators, a sex pillow, all-natural lube, and so much more to come. Founded by a sex educator and an engineering whiz, Dame develops bedroom solutions with the help of real humans and real couples like you. They're closing the pleasure gap and helping the world one vulva at a time. And the best part? Dame offers hassle-free returns within 60 days, so your satisfaction is quite literally guaranteed. Go to dameproducts.com/lovecast today for $10 off an Eva of your own.
Hey, Dan. I met a man on an online dating app 4 months ago. I'm 41, never been married, no children. He's 42. I could tell he was going through a divorce and not really ready to date, even though he didn't say that. I realized the guy was never going to meet up with me, deleted my profile, but also realized that he worked with a friend of mine. A friend of mine who I always knew had a crush on me, but he never asked me about it. He never asked me on a date. He never made a move. He never gave me a chance to reject him. I liked what this person brought into my life as a friend, and I thought I had the situation under control. I don't think it's super unusual to have a friend of the opposite sex who you know is kind of into you but knows it's never going to happen. Eventually, I tell my friend, who I had been hanging out with a bit more in group situations with other single people, that I know this guy. It all comes out. He had kind of figured it out too. He asked for my number. My friend acts really protective of me and doesn't want to give it to him, even though I asked him to give the guy my number. He does. He finally asked me out. We go out a couple times. We have a great time. Both times he asked me first if I ever dated that friend, which I never did. That was on our first date. On our second date, he brings it up again. And I say, no, I would never date him. He says, why not? He's just not my type. I'm not attracted to him. And, you know, even beyond that, I just wouldn't date someone like him. There's things about his personality that don't work for me. I go on vacation for a week, and this guy is, as far as I know, like super into me in a cool way where I think I'm going to see him again. I don't hear from him on vacation. I get back. I feel like he's blowing me off. I kind of try to send him a text that makes it clear, like, I get that you're blowing me off, like, hey, I'm busy too. Glad you're good. Have a great week. He then decides to tell me, it's become really clear that our mutual friend has a big thing for you. I'll call you. We can talk about it. And basically, the guy uses that as his reason why he can't date me. What I want to know from you, Dan, is what the fuck? Like, what do you think? Obviously, I think that's an excuse. My friends are completely divided, where some of my friends are like, you need to blow up your mutual friend. He meddled. He cock-blocked you. Other friends are like, no, the divorce dad sucks. It's complex. What do you think?
I have no idea what happened here. You have no idea, and you never will know what happened. So your only option is to shrug this shit off and not think about it. Didn't work out with the guy you went on a couple of dates with. Maybe your mutual friend interfered, or maybe the guy you went out on a couple of dates with He's a big believer in the bro code, or he was squicked out and values his friendship with your mutual friend so highly that he didn't want to risk it by dating someone that he had a crush on, and he just pulled the ripcord. But you'll never know for sure. And so I think you should not waste too much time thinking about it or bothering sex and relationship advice podcast hosts with it, because it's ultimately unknowable. I will say this, though. A lot of people have a friend of the opposite sex. Some people have a friend of the same sex that they know are crushed out on them. And it's a fine thing to be friends with someone who wished it could have been more, so long as you both have really understood that in your bones and grieved it, and the friendship isn't damaging to either of you. It can be very damaging for someone who's carrying a torch to be the friend. It can be tempting, consciously or subconsciously, for the person who is friends with someone they know is carrying a torch for them, tempting to exploit that friendship, because someone who wishes it could be more is often going to make themselves more available to you emotionally than someone who only is interested in your friendship and isn't pining and hoping against hope that maybe your feelings for them will change. And so I hope that there's nothing exploitative about your relationship with the mutual friend. I hope that you aren't consciously or subconsciously exploiting or leveraging his feelings for you to get more out of your friendship with him than you have a right to expect from a friendship, as opposed to a romantic relationship. If you're only hanging out with him when you're with large groups of mutual friends, doesn't sound like you are. But it's something you might want to think about, and it's certainly something that I've seen other people, without realizing they were doing it, do. Life can be stressful. Between work, family, and everything in between, it's not always easy to find time for yourself. Talkspace Online Therapy makes taking care of your mental health more affordable and convenient than ever before. Simply provide your preference for therapy and Talkspace will match you with one of more than 5,000 therapists the very same day. Send your therapist unlimited text, audio, picture, or video messages from anywhere at any time. You no longer have to wait for your next appointment to talk about what's on your mind. With Talkspace, you can send unlimited messages to your dedicated therapist in the privacy of your device from anywhere at any time of day. And if you're having a tough time, you can always schedule a live video session with your therapist for extra support. And 1 month of therapy on the Talkspace platform costs about the same amount as a single face-to-face session. Best of all, you'll never have to wait a week to share what's on your mind. Talkspace has more than 5,000 licensed therapists who are experienced in addressing the challenges we all face. To match with your perfect therapist for a fraction of the price of traditional therapy, go to Talkspace.com. Make sure to use the code SAVAGE to get $65 off your first month and show your support for the Lovecast. Again, go to Talkspace.com and use the promo code SAVAGE.
Hi, Dan. I'm a 23-year-old straight female, though slightly questioning, but we'll get to that in a second. My boyfriend and I have been together for going on 4 years. We've had some really incredible experiences together, both sexually and non. He is 13 years my senior and also identifies as pansexual. A lot of the experience that we've had in the bedroom have been things that he's done before, but have been new to me. And it's been really great to kind of explore with him and get to know my sexuality and what I like. And he's been really honest and really patient with me about exploring my own sexuality and, you know, really comforting to trying things that I might want to try and doing things that he might like to try. My issue is that we've been talking about more recently venturing into adding other people in the bedroom, both males and females. In my fantasies, I think I would enjoy having somebody else in the bedroom, although I know myself and I know that sometimes I can verge on a jealous person or I have feelings that I don't know. I just don't know how I'm going to react. Like I said, he's been super patient with me. We've been really open to talking about how I might feel. I just don't want to do something that could jeopardize our relationship. But I know that this is something that he really wants, and I want to be able to do it for him. But I just don't know how I'm going to feel about it.
The advice they give the swingers and people interested in cuckolding applies to your circumstance, too. There's a step before you and your boyfriend in bed with someone else, having sex with someone else. That's you and your boyfriend going out to a public place and seeing him flirt with someone else or seeing him make out with someone else. And you also maybe making out or flirting with someone else. You can go to a bar, you can go to a club, you can go to a sex party, you can go to a swingers club with the understanding that nothing is going to happen other than flirting. And then we're going to gauge my reaction. We're going to see how that feels for me and see how it feels for him if you also flirt or make out on a dance floor with somebody else. Then if you decide to go to bed with someone else, you need to be very clear with each other about what's allowed, what can happen. You have to determine what's on the menu in consultation with your very special guest star and then stick to it. And it may be that at least at first you want to reserve vaginal intercourse or penetrative intercourse, if you guys are going to have a male third, for yourselves. That those first times it'll be what the swingers call a soft swap. No vaginal or anal intercourse, just oral intercourse, mutual masturbation, a little bit of rolling around, where your very special guest star is kind of a sexy bolster, kind of a fun and sexy prop, but a person who wants to be that for you guys. So they're choosing to play that role for you. Maybe she sits on your boyfriend's face while you sit on his dick and you and she make out if that's what you guys want to do. But she doesn't sink down onto his dick. She doesn't get penetrated vaginally, no PIV for them. So there's still something held in reserve for you. And that holding in reserve serves two purposes. It has two functions. First, if penetrative sex, if PIV sex is very emotionally significant for you, it puts that to one side and that is just for you. Also, seeing your partner in the moment honor the commitment that they made to you to hold these things, the PIV or whatever else you want reserved just for you, makes you feel safer with your partner. It engenders more trust in your partner in these scenes, that they are going to prioritize your emotional and sexual safety in such a way that it's less likely to trigger your jealousy. All that said, when you do start playing with other people, if you do start playing with other people, I tell everyone before they have their first three-way, you really can't have a three-way if you aren't comfortable with the inevitable moment when that three-way turns into a two-way. There is always going to be a moment where your partner is focused on that other person and that other person is briefly focused on your partner and you are on the outside. And if you like seeing your partner with other people, being on the outside, not so bad. If this only works if you are constantly included, talk about in advance that moment when it becomes a two-way, when it's the two of you or me and the other person and we've kind of lost you or you've dropped out, speak up. Say, excuse me, can you guys pull me back in so I don't have a meltdown? Just be direct and honest about what you're feeling even in that moment and ask to be pulled back in. But brace yourself for that moment because it comes in every three-way. Every three-way is occasionally a two-way. All right, before we get to your response calls, let's read some of your tweets. Jane R. LeBlanc tweets, listening to so many callers self-hate over questioning relationships with no sexual compatibility makes me sad and angry. Sex is important and you have a right to good sex. Life is so short. Bad sex is a legit reason to end things. Hashtag Savage Lovecast. Couldn't agree more. I say that to people all the time. People have it in their heads that if they prioritize sexual compatibility over other things that you might also want to prioritize early in a relationship, that they're being bad or dirty or sex obsessive in some way. No, prioritize sexual compatibility. Also, particularly important to do so, as I like to say, in those sexually exclusive relationships. Proofrock tweets, why am I allowed to care about people's appearances and be attracted to certain aspects of the person's looks? But if I want a man who's taller than me, then I need to get over myself. Why can't I care about height? But I can say I like men with brown eyes. And finally, Cassandra T tweets, hey, at Fake Dan Savage, just to clarify something, escape rooms only last an hour and the staff are constantly watching you on cameras to monitor where you are and your puzzles to help and for safety. So escape rooms are a great second date idea. Hashtag Savage Lovecast. We're going to have to agree to disagree about that. I don't think it's a good first, second, third, fourth, or 50th date idea to be locked in a room with someone. Yeah, not my idea of fun. All right, if you want us to read your tweet potentially on an upcoming show, be sure to include the hashtag Savage Lovecast. And now your response calls.
Hi, Dan. I'm calling in response to episode 670, where you told that gentleman that no one can experience NRE in a long-term relationship. I'm here to disagree with your blanket statement that no one can, because I have found that balance, although it isn't easy. The way that I accomplish this is by having long-term flings with guys where maybe we take 6 months off and I'm agonizing about missing them. Then they come back and I feel that NRE again. There are two or three guys in my life with whom I've had this kind of relationship. The longest one has lasted for about 7 years. Not to brag or anything, but it is possible if you're willing to go through a bunch of emotional turmoil. You might even enjoy it.
Hi, Dan. I'm calling in response to the girl who didn't like the spontaneous dates, and I just felt like giving a female perspective. I don't really hang out at home with my hair and makeup done, kind of stay ready, and a second date would be a little soon to kind of feel comfortable showing up without my hair and makeup done. Perhaps maybe I'm just too girly, but that would be something that I would save for somebody that I'm more comfortable with and trust. Just because, you know, you want somebody to think you're so cute, and it would be a little soon to kind of just look like a mess. Just giving a girl's perspective on that.
Hi, Dan. I am responding to the caller with the outrage about people refusing to date quote-unquote short men. I have 2 points to make. First of all, you said that gay men don't suffer from this problem, and I appreciate that you've been married for a while and haven't been on the dating scene, but as a single gay man who is dating currently and is 5'9", which I don't think is all that short, I can tell you that this kind of heightist behavior is alive and well in gay land, as you put it, to the point that some profiles on dating apps, men even specify the exact height to the inch that they want their partners to be, which is always above 6 feet. So this is a thing that happens. Secondly, to the caller, I too used to be annoyed by this phenomenon, and I felt a little self-conscious about it until I chose to look at it as a little bit of a blessing, because if someone is shallow enough to tell me that they are not interested in me because of my height, then this is a person who will probably have issues with my aging body when that time comes. So based on this alone, they've made themselves undesirable. People just need to realize that those couple of inches don't make a person any less of an asshole. These are not the things that matter.
And we're going to leave it there. 206-302-2064 is the number here at the Savage Lovecast. If you want to record a question or a comment for a future show, give us a buzz. 206-302-2064. Tickets are on sale now for the opening weekends of the 15th Annual Hump Film Festival in Seattle, San Francisco, Portland, and for the first time ever, Vancouver, British Columbia, also Olympia, Washington. Go to humpfilmfest.com to get your tickets to those first screenings of brand new Hump. Follow me on Twitter at FakeDanSavage. Follow Dr. Jennifer Gunter on Twitter at Dr. Jen Gunter. And be sure to check out Paul Sullivan's Wealth Matters column in the New York Times. Savage Lovecast is produced every week by Nancy Hartunian and me and the tech-savvy at-risk youth and Nancy. We'll all be back at you next week with an installment of Savage Lovecast. Thanks for joining.